Word of exhortation from Brother Philip. Ask him now, please, to come forward. Brother Philip.
So again, my dear brothers and sisters, we have in the last week commenced reading the book of Joshua. That book which provides many interesting incidents, does it not, and lessons for us as we walk towards our land promised to us. What we particularly want to look at, by way of exhortation this afternoon, is the incident in tomorrow's chapter from the book of Joshua, the account of the deception of the Gibeonites. It is perhaps one of the most intriguing of all the incidents in this book, and one which gives rise to several questions. In fact, one might almost, if one did not know better, come to the conclusion that the purpose of Yahweh had been thwarted by the schemes of man. We know, of course, that cannot happen, that whatever God wills will most certainly be accomplished, no matter what man may decide to do. But the question may and often is asked, why did God allow Joshua to be deceived in this way? Joshua, after all, was a man with inspiration. He was a prophet sent by God to lead the people, was he not? Moses' successor. How was it then that he didn't know that the Gibeonites were lying? And why was it that afterwards that Israel could have been bound by the covenant? Because normally one is not bound by promises which are obtained by deceit. Nevertheless, we know in fact that that was the case, that the Gibeonites held afterwards a very privileged position, as we shall see, in Israel. They were protected in later years. You recall how Saul slew some of them and how vengeance was taken upon his family because he had broken this covenant which Gibeon had made with Joshua. In the 14th verse of the 9th chapter of Joshua, we do read a statement that could be construed as a criticism. Joshua 9 verse 14, and the men of Israel took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh. The statement could be construed as a criticism of the children of Israel, and yet there is no direct word from God of rebuke in this case. And in fact, if we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 20, we see that taking the facts as they were presented themselves to Israel on their face value, they acted strictly in accordance with the law, with the law of Moses, the law which had been given to Moses. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 22 we have very specific instructions given to Israel regarding their conduct in time of war. Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 10. When thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it, and it shall be, if it make the answer of peace and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. Verse 15, thus thou shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations. We notice that expression, cities which are very far off from thee. Words which are quoted almost word for word by the Gibeonites. But this did not apply to the nations that then occupied the promised land. Verse 16. But of the cities of these people, which Yahweh thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth, but thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, and the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as Yahweh thy God hath commanded thee, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations which they have done unto their gods. So should ye sin against Yahweh your God. And so the children of Israel, believing that the Gibeonites had come from very far off from them, acted not in accordance with the law in verses 16 to 18, but in that which had preceded them. So they acted precisely in accordance with the law. And of course, there was no hope whatsoever for the Gibeonites in the normal way. For Israel were not given any discretion at all as to how they should act towards the people of the land. And it is very clear that the Gibeonites knew this very well. Let's go back, if we will, to Joshua chapter 9. As far as the Gibeonites were concerned, there were just two courses of action open to them. The first was to fight against Israel. And we see in the beginning of Joshua chapter 9 that is precisely what the other cities of the land did. It came to pass when all the kings which were on this side Jordan, in the hills and in the valleys, and in all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, heard thereof, that is of the defeat of Ai, as we have just read together, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. But the Gibeonites did not join in this confederacy. They knew that it would fail, because we read in verse 24, and they, the Gibeonites, answered Joshua, this is after the deceit was discovered, and said, because it was certainly told thy servants how that Yahweh thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you, therefore we were sore afraid of our lives because of you and have done this thing. So they knew that opposition would fail. They also knew that to enter voluntarily into openly into a league would fail. So they took the only course which they could think of, and that was subterfuge. And in the circumstances, brothers and sisters, can we really blame them? After all, they had nothing to lose. If they failed, they would be no worse off than if they did nothing at all. Now, usually when we consider this incident in Joshua chapter 9, we think of it from the point of view of Israel. Try to analyse what, if anything, Joshua did wrong. But this afternoon we want to try and to consider it from the point of view of the people of Gibeon. We will see, if we do this, that it throws quite a different light upon the incident. And we see, in fact, that although they used deceit, which in itself is of course quite wrong, nevertheless they acted from motives which were correct. They acted, in fact, did they not, from the fear of Yahweh, which was to be shown in his servants. They recognised the power of Yahweh. They fully accepted that they could not stand before him. And so they humbled themselves and willingly became the servants of Israel. If we go over to the New Testament, to the epistle to the Ephesians in the second chapter, the apostle here speaks of the position of the saints in Ephesus before they had obeyed the call of the gospel. Position, of course, which applied to us, did it not? Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 12, that at that time ye were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. And of course it is a very accurate description, is it not, of the state of the men of Gibeon. For they were aliens from the commonwealth of Israel. They were strangers from the covenants of promise. The land of Canaan, which hitherto had been their land, was promised by God through his covenant to Israel, and they were to be displaced. They were a people with no hope, none at all, and they were without God in the world, for the gods which they worshipped were no gods. But returning again to Joshua chapter 9, we see what, under these circumstances, they did. Joshua chapter 9 and verse 3. Contrast to what the other nations did, as described in the first two verses. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, they did work wilily, and went and made as if they had been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles, old and rent and bound up, and old shoes, and clouted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and mouldy. So So we see that the record tells us that they did work wilily. And that is a very interesting word. It's only found five times in the original of the Old Testament. If we look up Strong's Concordance, we learn that it means either trickery or discretion. Now certainly the Gibeonites employed trickery, but there was discretion also in their action. On the other occasions when we find the word, once it comes in the context of the law concerning the cities of refuge, to state that a person who slays another with guile would not seek protection. The other three occasions are all found in the book of Proverbs. We'll have a look at them, because they use it in fact in this word in a good sense. Proverbs chapter 1, part of the introductory passage to this book. Proverbs chapter 1, the first verse. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment and equity, to give subtlety, and that's the word, to give subtlety to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. The wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto counsel. So then it is this word subtlety, that which was to be given to the simple. Then we turn over to the 8th chapter. It's of course still on this theme of the true wisdom of God. Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 5. O ye simple, understand wisdom, and ye fools, be of an understanding heart. And in this verse it's the word wisdom, which is the same as is widely in Joshua. And again it comes in verse 12. This time it's translated prudence. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and find out knowledge of witty inventions. So of course in all of these three references from Proverbs, it is a word describing the wisdom derived from the fear of Yahweh. And it was from the fear of Yahweh, certainly in a very rudimentary form, which was behind the actions of the men of Gibeon. They feared very much what Yahweh, through the people of Israel, was to do to them. And then we go over to Matthew chapter 10, and we are reminded of some words of Jesus to his disciples. The occasion was when Jesus sent his disciples out to preach and to heal the sick. Matthew 10 and verse 16. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. That also, we suggest, was the attitude of the Gibeonites. They were wise as serpents. They used guile to obtain their ends. But whereas the serpent in Eden had used guile to bring harm to the creation of God, the Gibeonites were harmless. Harmless as doves, the symbol of peace. For it was peace which they desired. They could, of course, if they had been so minded, have used their trickery to infiltrate the camp of Israel to gain advantage in war. But there's not the slightest suggestion that that was ever their intention. Their purpose was to make peace with Israel and with Yahweh. And we know that they achieved this purpose. Now, was it contrary to the will of God? Well, assuredly not. God never allows his purpose to be frustrated by the schemes of men. But rather do we see in this incident an example of the purpose of God with the Gibeonites being achieved while leaving his principles intact. Because here quite clearly was a people who displayed a correct attitude. Had such matters such as this been left to the discretion of the children of Israel, had it been left for them to decide who was worthy of peace and who not, without doubt very many people would have been saved who should not have been. That happened as it was, did it not? Because they broke the law. Israel did in fact exercise discretion in saving certain of the people of the land, and in every case they led them astray. But the Gibeonites did not lead them astray. And so Yahweh was able by this means to allow a situation to develop in which the law concerning the aliens was not intentionally broken, and yet for him to extend to these people his protection. But these things, of course, brothers and sisters, are recorded, are they not, for our learning, and we can obtain help by studying the actions of these men to aid us in our lives within the covenants of promise. Now, the actions of these Gibeonites were not what we would normally expect from a people seeking to make a league with a feared conqueror. The usual method implied in ancient times, Israel themselves employed it many times, did they not, against Egypt, against Assyria, was to send ambassadors to the conquering enemy with a present consisting of costly goods in order to buy their favour. But the Gibeonites knew that that would not succeed, and their actions in this case are evidence that they were perfectly familiar with the law under which Israel was bound. It is clear that they knew perfectly well that law which we looked at, which is recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 20. They knew that only if they could be accepted as having come from a far country had they any hope at all. No costly presents would bring them mercy. And that attitude of theirs is typical of the attitude which all people must adopt if they would escape the just judgments of Yahweh. For they came wearing old, worn out garments. And man's own provision to cover his sin is of the same condition, is it not? And so we read in Isaiah chapter 64, all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. And the Gibeonites came dressed in filthy rags. Typical that they have no provision of their own to save them. Their food was dry and mouldy. Their food which they brought was quite useless for the sustenance of life. And so, brothers and sisters, is the food which we provide for ourselves. It will maintain us, of course, for a few brief years of this mortality. It's no use at all in the land of promise to which we look. And they said, we become from a far country. And man in his natural state is indeed very far away from the land promised by Yahweh. And if we would attain to that land, brothers and sisters, then we must, from a spiritual point of view, make a very long journey. We must travel in the exactly opposite direction from that in which we were previously headed. And of course, we know that there are very few who are willing to do that. There are very few willing to do so in Canaan. Most of the people banded together to fight against Israel. But the Gibeonites were a small exception. They were a minority that was different from the rest. And they realized that they must come from a very far country and be seen to come from a far country if they were to be found acceptable. And those that do so, like them, must humble themselves, must thoroughly abase themselves, recognizing their utter and complete weakness. And having made this long journey, it is with a request to be the servants, the slaves of Yahweh. So we must quite voluntarily, of our own free will, relinquish any freedom and liberty which we may have thought we possessed, living henceforth only to fulfil the work of our Lord and Master. Going back again to Joshua chapter 9, in addition to their humility and their willingness to serve, they also accepted that ultimately they relied upon mercy. Because when their deceit was discovered, they did not attempt to justify themselves. They didn't even claim protection, saying, well, you've already agreed to save our lives, so that's how the matter must rest. No, not at all. Read in Joshua chapter 9, verse 25, and now, behold, we are in thine hand, as it seemeth good and right unto thee to do unto us. Do. So they lay themselves completely at the disposal of the children of Israel. In effect, they said, yes, we have deceived you. Makes no difference. Our fate is in your hands. And of course, that is also our position, is it not, brethren and sisters? We indeed must act with discretion. We must seek the one way of escape from our naturally hopeless position. We must humble ourselves, seeking service under Jesus, our Joshua. But having done all this, and indeed we have done, have we not? We know that even now, not one of us can lay claim to life. But if we are at the day of judgment granted entrance into that kingdom, it is simply at the mercy of Yahweh that we will be admitted, because he sees fit to be merciful unto us. We know that they were granted their request, that Joshua made them slaves. He made them hewers of wood and drawers of water. Verse 26. And so did he unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, that they slew them not. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of Yahweh, even unto this day, in the place which he should choose. A few weeks earlier, in Moses' final words recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 29, Moses had made a distinct reference to people of that occupation, hewers of wood and drawers of water. Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 10. Ye stand this day, all of you, before Yahweh your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders and your officers, with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and thy stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into covenant with Yahweh thy God, and into his oath, which Yahweh thy God maketh with thee this day. And so those who draw water and hew wood are specifically mentioned as being in covenant relationship with Yahweh. So when Joshua put that work upon the Gibeonites, he was in fact bringing them into the covenant of Israel, was he not? They were no longer to be aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, but they were brought into them, into that covenant relationship. But they were not ordinary slaves. And indeed, in that last verse of Joshua chapter 9, we were informed also that not only were they hewers of wood and drawers of water, but they were to do this for what was needed for the altar of Yahweh. And yet Israel was clearly told that the service of the tabernacle and all its furnishings was strictly reserved for the tribe of Levi. Back to Numbers chapter 1, we're told very specifically of the penalty for any person other than a Levite who presumed to take on any work connected with these holy things. Numbers chapter 1 and verse 49. Only thou shalt not number the tribe of Levi, neither take the sum of them among the children of Israel, but thou shalt appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of testimony, and over all the vessels thereof, and over all things that belong to it. They shall bear the tabernacle and all the vessels thereof, and they shall minister unto it, and shall encamp round about the tabernacle. When the tabernacle setteth forward, the Levites shall take it down, and when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death. So anyone in the children of Israel who was not a Levite, who approached unto these things to do any work for the tabernacle, no matter how good his intentions may have been, he should be put to death. But the Gibeonites, these people who came from outside, these people who were redeemed from amongst the people of the land, they were given work associated with the altar of Yahweh. These Gentiles were to undertake work which no one of Israel other than the Levites could undertake. And again, brothers and sisters, this is our position, is it not? Apart from the Levites, the natural seed of Israel could not approach to the holy things. But we are privileged to approach unto the altar. This is why we are met here round the table of memorial this afternoon. For Christ Jesus is our altar, and as we have just sung, he is our high priest. He who was first of all put off his filthy rags, did he not, as Zechariah saw in type in the person of the Joshua of his day. He provided the bread of life for us, which does not perish, has provided garments which will never become old. He humbled himself as a servant, and he, though he did no sin, also cast himself on the mercy of his Father. And it was in this way that he became our altar, an altar which we can approach without the need for any priesthood in between. And so we hold a position, brethren and sisters, of very great privilege. It is a very exalted position, despite the humility which we needed to attain unto it. And it is particularly, of course, in the partaking of the emblems upon the table that we are brought face to face with our altar. Therefore, as the Apostle says, we need to examine ourselves before partaking, to sanctify our minds, to renew in our minds that attitude which we had in our baptism, that same attitude of humility and dependence upon Yahweh's mercy, which was shown by the people of Gibeon. Yet, of course, we make a mistake if we think that this which we do on the first day of the week is our only approach to the altar. This action is a memorial of what has been done for us, that we might henceforth live continuously in all aspects of our life as faithful servants. And our work for the altar is, or should be, in all that we do. It is in the work which we sometimes term work for the truth, but it is in all our other activities as well. So indeed there should be nothing at all that we do that is inconsistent with our service at the altar which has been provided for us. If we could at any time engage in any activity which does not in some way or other help us to serve the Lord in faith, then it is indeed something which we should not be doing. It applies to the way in which we earn our living, providing those things which we need to sustain these present mortal lives so that we can serve God more faithfully and ultimately have a place in that glorious kingdom. But we should also, of course, bear in mind the first characteristic of the Gibeonites, that point about them, the reason why they saw the need to use discretion in order to gain salvation. It was because they knew, to some extent at least, they knew the word of Yahweh. They knew and they believed what had been commanded to Israel. They didn't just think, well, perhaps we might not receive mercy. They knew that Israel had been commanded to slay all the people of the land. And it was only by separating themselves from the people of the land, by approaching in a different way, that they had any hope whatsoever of saving their lives. Of course, it was because of our knowledge of the word that we, at first, entered the waters of baptism, and to continue in the service of Yahweh we need to maintain and indeed to increase our knowledge of that word. And so let us not, as some in this day and age do, let us not doubt what we have always believed. There is a strong tendency in the community today to cast doubt upon what Christadelphians have believed for over 130 years, and many have become rather uncertain in their minds. This can only make us unstable in our service, with the ultimate result that we may in the end find ourselves once again aliens to the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, with no hope and without God in the world. And so, brothers and sisters, let us keep clear before us our visions of the future glory. And again, of course, this incident can help us, can it not? For the book of Joshua tells of Joshua leading Israel into the land of promise, vanquishing the enemies of Yahweh. And so it is typical of our Joshua leading Israel after the Spirit in the land of promise in the day shortly to be revealed, bringing Yahweh's judgments upon his enemies. And in that day, many nations will band themselves together to fight against him, just as the kings described in the first verse of Joshua chapter 9 did against Joshua of old. But there will be those nations in the age to come which, like the Gibeonites, will humble themselves, will seek his peace. There will be no need for them to use trickery, but they will need to show a true discretion, for they will need to know that there is no hope in themselves, only by becoming the servants of the great king in that day. If we, brothers and sisters, are found sufficiently faithful to be given a place amongst those immortal rulers of the age to come, then it will be our task, will it not, to teach them more perfectly of the ways of God. So let us now show in this present life this same godly attitude, that in the age to come we may be amongst those that receive this privilege.